From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It is Here and Now. This morning, the fraught $4 billion merger between the Sinclair Broadcast Group and Tribune Media came to a dramatic end when Tribune pulled out of the deal and announced it is suing Sinclair for breach of contract. Sinclair owns nearly 200 local TV stations across the country, and it would have swelled to reach even more markets if the deal had gone through, creating a conservative TV giant that would rival Fox News.
We want to spend a few minutes on this and other stories media with NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who joins us here in the studio. David, we know this is a huge business story, but remind us more of why it's a big deal to you, media correspondent.
Well, it's a $3.9 billion deal. It represents an extraordinary proposed consolidation of local TV beyond what it already was. You know, Sinclair already owns controls about 190 stations, would have added 40 more, although they would have sold some of them.
And we've talked about this. Sinclair is a station that actually is requiring some of its anchors to, you know, have partisan thoughts on the air. It's an interesting conservative outlet.
Well, what they've been doing is essentially kind of building a conservative national network from the local stations up rather than in reverse. And so they really have, although some of their stations do good local coverage, they really do have a ton of content that is mandated that their news stations carry that is not only conservative, but explicitly pro President Trump in many ways. And it's a publicly traded company, Sinclair, but the four Smith brothers who control the company effectively are quite conservative and have made that known in a variety of ways.
Yeah, and so the head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, is under investigation for his ties to Sinclair. So remind people who haven't been following this, how much of that factored into the FCC's decision before Tribune pulled out to slow this merger down?
Well, this is the crazy thing, right? So Tribune this morning announces it's pulling out of this deal and said that Sinclair had acted too aggressively and basically offended Ajit Pai, who said that there were really some efforts of this to apparently sell some of the stations in order to comply with certain regulations to companies that seemed still to be under the influence and control of Sinclair itself, despite federal rules prohibiting that. Mm-hmm. Ajit Pai had greased the skids, it appears, to ensure that this deal could go through by sweeping away rules or putting, I should actually say, back in place certain rules that were, you know, archaic to the point of just trying to get Sinclair under the wire. And so that is what the inspector general did, was to say, you know, was he arranging things with a lobbyist who used to work at the FCC, who was working on Sinclair's behalf early in the Trump administration to make sure this deal would happen? Ajit Pai turning around while under investigation for that very question and saying, you know, this deal is too much for me. I can't do it. Even though President Trump himself, and I think it was late July, tweeted out how sorry he was this deal appeared to be getting slowed down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, David, how do Rupert Murdoch and people at Fox News feel about this deal collapsing today?
You know, there are some people who say Rupert Murdoch, you know, be sorry about it. He was going to pick up a half dozen or so stations from Sinclair as part of the deal, them shedding assets. But in reality, you could look at this as the media scholar Nikki Usher and others have argued as kind of an internal intramural fight in conservative media. You saw Christopher Ruddy, a friend of the president's, the head of Newsmax, a conservative outlet, very opposed to this deal. Rupert Murdoch quietly behind the scenes been lobbying Trump against it as well. The FCC is supposed to be independent, but it seems as though it's been bending a little bit this way and that to try to fall in sync with where some of the president's key backers might find themselves.
We want to talk about some other stories, but just briefly, what reason is Tribune giving for suing Sinclair now?
It's saying it's a breach of contract, that Sinclair was supposed to make sure that this deal moved ahead smoothly, but that it's overly aggressive moves. It's flouting the directives of the FCC. It's trying to do side deals with entities that it, one way or another, might still have control of, constitute such egregious actions the FCC was compelled to put the brakes on rather than to the accelerator. And that for it derailed the deal.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will continue to follow this story. David, we also want to ask you about Alex Jones. We've been talking about him all week. This is the man behind InfoWars, this website that peddles in far-right conspiracy theories. Google, Facebook, Apple, they all removed Jones' videos and podcasts from their sites. But now the InfoWars app is trending. People are finding a way to get their Alex Jones fix on those very same platforms, which I guess means Alex Jones is still able to get his message out.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that, you know, Alex Jones has said that he's being censored by the giants of Silicon Valley working in concert in sort of a monopolistic fashion. Of course, when I wanted to find out his reaction to some of these major social media platforms banning some of his main accounts, I did so by Googling to find his Facebook account, where he had posted a streaming video he had on Periscope, which is owned by Twitter. It's his Twitter account. So, you know, he's using social media and online ways of getting to people. Apple has judged that his app does not violate their terms of service. So he's able to get his message out. This is a guy who's, casting himself as a First Amendment martyr. Interestingly, in talking to First Amendment scholars and people active on this issue, they say, look, these private companies, as giant as they may be, have certain First Amendment rights too. But there are questions when they are so pervasive in our conversation about the role they play in refereeing or not refereeing the conversation. What it seems now is that a lot of decisions are being made ad hoc on the fly rather than being clear and consistent.
Well, and to remind people that Alex Jones is the one who's behind the theories that the mass shootings are fakes, that people are actors.
That's right. At Sandy Hook, the elementary school in Connecticut, that was faked by the families that are survivors. A terrible thing to argue. He claimed that the Bush administration was somehow involved in an inside job to help arrange for 9/11. A terrible slander.
That Hillary Clinton had children in a pedophile ring in the basement of a pizza place and a guy with a gun went
to freedom. He certainly entertained and promoted those theories in just wild-eyed ways that are not responsible, and platforms have a right to decide what they are willing to put on them.
But, you know, it's like whack-a-mole. So the InfoWars app, as Jeremy mentioned, this is in the Apple Store. It was the 47th most popular in the news category before these bans. Now it's the third most downloaded news app. And I've listened to Alex Jones. I have for decades. He's also driving people to his website, telling them, please buy my merchandise,
right?
You know, support me. And they are. I suppose, you know, that's the American way. I mean, if he, you know, if people want to entertain him elsewhere or what, you've got a look. Wouldn't you rather have some way of hearing him to know what Americans are listening to than have it be the way Alex Jones used to be, which is that a lot of people didn't know he was there?
These are the arguments that officials at YouTube and Facebook, including Mark Zuckerberg and at other sites, have often used. I mean, Zuckerberg, you know, a few weeks ago was arguing that he wanted to make sure Holocaust deniers, you know, had a place on his platform for
everybody
people
gets
to banter
to be wrong.
Back and forth. Everybody gets to be wrong. Yeah. And he's, you know, he's vacillating back and forth. Is he a utility where people get to post things more analogous to telephone company, or is he a publisher where he is exercising some discretion? You know, Facebook decided to exercise some discretion here, and they don't have clarity on how they're making these decisions, even if people may cheer the decision in this case. You know, you've seen Jonathan Last in the Conservative Weekly Standard saying, yes, they should be doing this to Alex Jones, even though a lot of conservatives are kind of rallying to his cause, but he's saying they should be going after a lot of other people too.
David, one more story we want to get to here with you, and that is Fox News host Laura Ingraham, who stoked some more controversy last night for bemoaning the impact of immigration.
In some parts of the country, it does seem like the America that we know and love doesn't exist anymore. Massive demographic changes have been foisted upon the American people, and they're changes that none of us ever voted for and most of us don't like. From Virginia to California, we see stark examples of how radically, in some ways, the country has changed. Now, much of this is related to both illegal and, in some cases, legal immigration that, of course, progressives love.
Now, David, this is a well-known, you know, conservative commentator on Fox News, got her own show now. But was there something different about this? It's getting a lot of attention today.
You know, there's a line in her commentary where she says it's not about race or ethnicity. It's very hard to listen to what she had to say in that commentary and not come away thinking that that's exactly what it's about. She talked about these stark demographic changes that's changing America in ways that we don't recognize. That's a slight paraphrase of what she said. And, you know, the real question is, who's the we she's talking about? You know, America's been built on waves of immigration, and, you know, her ultimate boss was born in Australia and immigrated to this country, Rupert Murdoch. This is a country where, you know, that's been accepted and people pay lip service to that or else take a very extreme position, which she has. what I think is notable is that people are saying, you know, there's a veneer that has been lifted off in this case, and it's coming very close to stoking certain kinds of explicit racial tensions.
You could take her words, and I wish I had done this, and put in Italian or Irish. You could probably take the exact statement that she made and hear it from 50, 60, 70 years ago about another immigrant population that came to this country. I know you wanted to mention something you've seen in New York, Jeremy.
Well, I was just walking down the street this morning, David, in Manhattan, and saw a city bus drive by with a Fox News ad on the side that said, "Real news, real honest opinion," with the pictures of all of the stars, Hannity, Tucker, Laura Ingraham. I just thought that was interesting. Real honest opinion.
And I want to mention that later in the program today, worth noting, we're going to be hearing from a woman whose son was killed by an undocumented immigrant driving drunk. And he had been, you know, in court several times and released. And so she has a legitimate question about that. Listen, we'll take all of this up again. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, soon to be co-host of WBUR's On Point with Meghna Chakrabarty. Can't wait for that. David, thank you.
You bet.
This is a scene from the highest grossing film of the year so far.
I, Zuri, son of Badu, give to you Prince T'Challa, the Black Panther.
But could Black Panther also become an Oscar winner? Yesterday, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced some major changes to next year's Academy Awards ceremony, including a new category, Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film. Joining us now is John Horn, host of the KPCC show The Frame. He's in Pasadena. Hi, John.
Hello there.
And let's talk about this new category. It sounds like a response to the criticism that Best Picture winners are often films that don't draw in big crowds. I'm thinking about things like Moonlight or The Hurt Locker.
Yes, and the Academy Awards are not awards for blockbusters. They are awards for excellence in cinema. So if you take that idea and expand it to, say, restaurant dining, by that standard, Michelin stars would go to Chipotle or Olive Garden because they're right. popular, not the best restaurants like, say, the French Laundry out here or Masa in New York City. So first of all, they're about excellence. They're not about box office numbers. And second, if you look at even some recent history, there are a lot of films that are incredibly popular that do win Oscars. They may not win the big prize for Best Picture. Then this year's ceremony, Get Out, which grossed $176 million, won an original screenplay Oscar. It was also nominated for Best Director for Jordan Peele. And Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk, which almost made it to $200 million, won three Oscars. And Nolan was nominated for Best Director. So it isn't that there's a bias against popular movies, but that sometimes popular movies aren't as good as the Best Picture Oscar winners.
But I saw Black Panther, and I feel like Black Panther could have been a nominee, at least for Best Picture, even without being considered in the popular category.
Well, and that's the big issue. Could have been a nominee. Will it change now? And I think there's some recent history in the Academy that really kind of shows where this could go off the rails. And that is, in 2001, the Academy added a new Oscar for feature animated film. And what that meant is that animated films had their own category. But what it also meant is that some of the year's best films, I'm thinking of Inside Out from 2015, on any objective standard, one of the best films of the year was not nominated for Best Picture because it was shoehorned into the animated feature category. So the question is, does that happen to films like Black Panther? Does it get shoehorned out of the Best Picture race into the best popular film category if indeed that is what happens? So I think that's the potential problem, is that it becomes kind of a ghettoized category.
So the Oscars last year, lowest rating ever, down 20% from the previous year. And the other change that was announced yesterday is they want to keep the ceremony to 3 hours. So tell us about that part of it.
Well, listen, the Oscars are a long ceremony, but for a lot of people who care about movies, including me, it doesn't feel that long. I mean, it's like once a year. So they're going to try to trim it down. The other thing they're going to try to do is move it up in the calendar year, that the Oscar season really starts later this month with the Venice, Toronto, and Telluride film festivals that go into September. It is an epic length award season. So by moving it up in the calendar to February in the years ahead, it might help. They're also going to not broadcast some technical awards like sound, and that's going to be a problem, too, for that sound branch. So, yes, the ratings are slipping. How much of that is tied to the films that are being nominated? It's hard to say, but I think the backlash against this announcement has been really, really strong, and I really wonder if the Academy is going to follow through on it.
Well, we keep this segment to 4 minutes, so I will say goodbye to John Horn of KPCC. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Well, yesterday we heard about the high cost of housing in the San Francisco Bay Area and efforts by some residents to advocate for more affordable housing instead of not in my backyard, yes, in my backyard. San Francisco has some of the highest housing costs in the country. You know how that goes. Neighborhoods gentrify. A lot of longtime residents can't afford to live there. Yet one neighborhood is bucking the trend in San Francisco. The Tenderloin hasn't changed much over the past few decades, for better and for worse. Kelly O'Mara from the KQED podcast Bay Curious explores why.
The Tenderloin is the neighborhood tourists are told not to walk through. It has a reputation for having drug dealing out in the open, parts can be dirty, and the crime rate is high. As the rest of San Francisco has gotten fancier and more expensive, the Tenderloin has resisted gentrification. Why? And more importantly, how?
The Tenderloin is really a model for how communities across the country can stop gentrification.
Randy Shaw has been working in the Tenderloin since 1980, when he started the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. Shaw says during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, the neighborhood was the place to be. People came from all over to visit the Tenderloin's restaurants, jazz clubs, and bars. Even during Prohibition, the party raged on.
The Tenderloin from 1907 into the 50s was one of the most prosperous San Francisco neighborhoods.
Part of what made the neighborhood lively was not exactly legal. For a long time, the city looked the other way on gambling parlors and brothels.
Every great city of the world seems to have an area given over to the fleshly needs of men. In San Francisco, this area is called the Tenderloin.
The neighborhood was thriving until it all came crashing down.
City Hall intentionally wrecked the Tenderloin. They eliminated our gambling operation, which they had to do. They changed our street configuration. They took away our cable cars.
In the 1950s, San Francisco started cracking down on the Tenderloin's quasi-legal businesses. A lot of the nearby movie theaters and recording studios shuttered too. Then came crime and drug dealing. But many of the people who lived there found community in this ignored neighborhood. In the 60s and 70s, it was home to the LGBT community, and it was an affordable place to live. Over the years, many of the Tenderloin's hotels had been repurposed.
And what the people did was they started renting them out to low-income people or people that just needed a week's rent, so they became sort of low-income housing.
Pam Coates has lived in the Tenderloin for 9 years in an SRO, a single-room occupancy residential hotel. Today, the Tenderloin and nearby Chinatown have more SROs than any of the other neighborhoods in the city.
It's a room, usually with a shared bath, and a little, you know, you've got a wash basin in it, and that's it. No cooking facilities at all. You have to sort of make your own.
SROs often offer a second chance for recovering addicts, domestic abuse survivors, and people getting off the streets. People like Coates.
I was on the street for 10 months. I'm a domestic violence survivor. And I got into Tenderloin, to the SRO, through the Tenderloin Housing Clinic. So that's how I found peace. This neighborhood offers that. It's new beginnings.
By the 1980s, money was pouring into San Francisco and changing nearby neighborhoods. And Tenderloin residents started to worry about preserving what they had, good and bad. They started to organize to stop gentrification. Today, the Tenderloin is relatively affordable. Although it's still San Francisco prices, a one-bedroom here rents for about $2,300. that's $1,000 less than in the rest of the city. And a rent-controlled SRO can cost as little as a few hundred dollars a month. Randy Shaw says that happened because of a few specific policy reasons. Number one.
There was an aggressive nonprofit acquisition of land when land was still cheap.
And a lot of those nonprofits now run affordable housing programs on those properties. Number two.
In 1985, we rezoned the neighborhood to prevent any building over 13 stories. Someone could not pick up a piece of land and build a 35-story luxury condominium in the Tenderloin because the zoning prohibits it.
They've also restricted non-residential uses above the second floor and required replacement of affordable housing units. These limits make it unappealing for developers who have to weigh the cost of building with the potential for profit. Number three, the city also made it very hard to get rid of SROs and their tenants. Today, between 25 and 29% of the housing units in the Tenderloin are designated permanently affordable.
Their goal, I think, was to protect the neighborhood from the speculative real estate market.
Jeff Buckley, the mayor's housing policy advisor, says the neighborhood's residents largely succeeded. There just haven't been as many people forced out of their homes as in other parts of the city.
We have seen, whether it's the owner move-ins or the no-fault evictions that have occurred at fairly high rates throughout San Francisco in the last 20 years, they have not happened in the Tenderloin.
But last year, the Tenderloin had more violent crime than almost any other neighborhood in San Francisco. And drug dealing is still common. In fact, when I was walking to meet Shaw, someone tried to sell me morphine. Residents and businesses, of course, aren't happy about the crime and have been trying to fix up their neighborhood. And the city is working on improvement projects, too, like putting in hundreds of new streetlights, fixing up the neighborhood's main park, and approving three new major housing projects. But can the Tenderloin improve without forcing out current residents? Again, Jeff Buckley.
It's a utopian idea, but I think it's one that they have tried to put into practice.
And advocates like Randy Shaw from the Tenderloin Housing Clinic believe it should be possible to get rid of crime and clean up the streets and still stay affordable.
We are on track to return to the days we were, but we shouldn't have to wait to get drug dealing off the street until the housing is open and everything is fine. It should happen now.
If they can do that, then this ignored spot in the heart of San Francisco could be an example for other cities dealing with the same issues. For Here and Now, I'm Kelly O'Mara.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The U.S. Army has temporarily stopped discharging immigrant recruits who enlisted in a program that gave them a path to citizenship. The program recruits non-citizens with certain medical or language skills, but earlier this summer, some recruits started being discharged as security risks. Carson Frame of Texas Public Radio reports from San Antonio.
The program's called Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest, or MAVNI. Under it, non-citizens could earn U.S. citizenship quicker in exchange for honorable military service. But over the last few months, advocates say at least 40 have been discharged, many without explanation or written notice. One Burmese recruit, who asked to remain unnamed because of immigration concerns, learned of his discharge in mid-July. He enlisted in the Army through the MAVNI program in 2016 and was still waiting for his background checks to clear.
So I did my monthly check-in with my recruiter. He was like, they told me that your records are expired. Everything on you is expired, so they canceled your contract.
The recruit says he was told that his background check was negative, but wasn't given any further details. Margaret Stock, an immigration attorney and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, says she's been hearing a lot of stories like that.
There's definitely been an uptick. I mean, I would say at least 40 people have contacted my office, but I'm only one lawyer in America, and I'm not the only lawyer everybody's calling.
Stock helped start the MAVNI program after 9/11 to help address a shortage of personnel with certain skills.
There was an effort throughout the U.S. military and intelligence communities to try to get more people working for the government who spoke foreign languages. However, the MAVNI program was also expanded at the request of the Department of Defense to include U.S. licensed healthcare professionals because there was a dire shortage of such individuals in the ranks of the military.
But controversy around the MAVNI program dates back to the Obama era. The government has suspended the program several times over concerns about foreign infiltration. Republican Congressman Stephen Russell of Oklahoma sits on the House Armed Services Committee.
You had those that were from countries that wished to do us harm and continue to attack us or try to infiltrate us through our intelligence.
In 2016, the Pentagon stopped accepting new applicants and began tougher background checks for people who had already applied. But Margaret Stock says those background checks led to a backlog, and she fears the government is trying to fix it now by arbitrarily discharging people. She says she's seen no evidence of serious wrongdoing by MAVNI recruits.
When you talk to the Pentagon, they keep hiding behind classified reports. They say, oh, there's a classified report that is hair-raising, you know. If it's so hair-raising, how come there's no public prosecutions, no public terrorism investigations, no court-martials, no denaturalizations? I mean, there's zero public information to indicate that there's some kind of major risk from this program.
Other lawsuits are pending, and Vladek says they may push the government to come up with a concrete justification for the discharges.
The fact that the response was basically to give up and surrender suggests that there may never have been a reason in the first place.
Meanwhile, Congressman Russell, a former Army officer, would prefer to see the program eliminated. He says he supports recruiting immigrants into the military, but says the MAVNI program presents too many obstacles, and the military has other ways to get the people it needs.
We have been briefed that they are meeting all of their skill requirements through other means, that the program is more problem than it's worth. It's not the only means to acquire skill, nor was the military unable to acquire skill before somebody came up with MAVNI.
The Defense Department said in a statement that it's working to complete background investigations for all applicants, and that 2 out of 3 do eventually make it through the vetting process. For Here and Now, I'm Carson Frame.
And that story from the American Homefront Project.
And all week we've been looking at borders. We're a country of immigrants who've crossed them, but how immigrants arrive and who gets to stay is a fraught national debate. Today, a mother who's drawing the line after an undocumented immigrant killed her son Brandon, a police officer, in a drunken car accident. She says, build a wall. Mary Ann Mendoza lives in Mesa, Arizona. She's one of a group of grieving family members who are victims of crimes caused by undocumented immigrants. President Trump calls them angel families. And Mary Ann Mendoza joins us from KJZZ in Tempe, Arizona. Mary Ann, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I am looking at a picture of your son in USA Today. What a lovely looking young man. We are so sorry.
Thank you.
Do you mind if we ask about that night?
We had just celebrated Mother's Day on May 11th, 2014, and had a wonderful day. And then he went on shift, and he stopped by to have dinner with me. And then the early morning of the 12th, I got a call from Afghanistan from one of his fellow Mesa police officers, who was also Air National Guard and deployed at that time, telling me, Mom, Brandon's been in a terrible accident. Mm-hmm. And I quickly got off the phone and tried to gather my thoughts and kept calling Brandon's phone, and he wasn't answering. And probably 10 minutes later, there was a knock on my door, and it was Mesa Police Department telling me I needed to come with him to the hospital. When I saw the police presence at the hospital, I knew it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. And probably 20 minutes after I arrived at the hospital, my son died in surgery, and my nightmare began.
Yeah. You were to discover that the driver of the other car, Paul Silva Corona, was going the wrong way, was drunk, was in the country illegally. But then to add to that, you discovered what about his past criminal record?
Well, he had been charged up in Colorado in the 90s for burglary, assaulting a police officer, and of course, usual fashion, they're given a court date to show up for, which he never did. And so he was on the run in our country. He was reapprehended in 2002 at the border, coming back into the country, and the judge showed him leniency and let him back out onto our streets. And it was shortly, a few weeks after Brennan's death, that I wrote a letter to President Obama at the time. And my fight has always been about the leniency that is shown to illegal alien criminals in our country. I don't think that they should be out on bail.
In your letter to President Obama, you were very angry. A lot of capital letters, you know, for somebody to be let out to commit further crimes and kill our loved ones is not acceptable to me. You've been asking for laws and restrictions. But the statistics show that undocumented immigrants are considerably less likely to commit crime than native-born citizens. I mean, it's just that study after study has shown this. In fact, areas that have more undocumented citizens have less crime than areas that don't. How do you hone in on someone who was an obvious problem, this person who drove the car that killed your son? How do you do that without adding to a national debate that some feel has tilted into hate-mongering?
Well, I've never been against immigration. My son worked with a lot of illegal aliens in his beat where he worked. There are good
Isn't your son partly Hispanic?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And there's people who come here for a better life. I get that. But crime statistics, whoever wants to say what they want to say, you know, they're going to get statistics from wherever they can to fit their narrative and their agenda of the article that they're writing. But quite frankly, one American killed by an illegal alien present in our country is one too many.
What are you suggesting that would change, for instance, what happened to your son? What can change?
The convicted illegal alien felons that are roaming our streets, they need to be deported from our country.
Well, but as you know, there's due process. This is America. So if they are charged with something, they have to go through the process for that.
These illegal alien felons have already been convicted of crimes and have been put on a deportation list, but they're just left to roam our country. They want due process in our country, but they're not forced to serve the time like you or I would be. They're just deported, and next week they'll walk back over the border and they'll be back because they know this is a joke.
You and others have been very vocal in your support of President Trump, but you know people are also comparing the statistics there. And President Obama actually deported a huge number of undocumented immigrants who had committed crimes. Are you happy with what President Trump has done? He promised a wall that would be paid for by Mexico. It hasn't happened. Are you satisfied?
I am satisfied with where it's headed. We have a Congress and a Senate who are putting up the roadblocks for not getting the border funding, the wall funding that we need. And Obama, a lot of those statistics were skewed with Obama. But listen, $136 billion a year is spent on illegal aliens in our country, supporting them with health care, with education, with food stamps, with housing. If that was all cut off tomorrow, we'd have a border wall built in the next year, because that's where our taxpayer money should go, and that's where it would go if we cut off the support to these people.
One of the things you've been calling for is more restrictions on undocumented immigrants, so they can't purchase or register cars in the U.S. without a driver's license. There are around a dozen states that allow undocumented immigrants to get a driver's license, and supporters of those laws letting undocumented immigrants get licenses say that at least these people might be trained. The roads will be safer. Here you are, who's lost a son on the roads. What about that idea of allowing undocumented immigrants to get licenses?
Absolutely not. They may take a vehicle to the DMV and you know, be able to get licensing and whatnot and have insurance on a car. This is another problem. They have insurance when they may go in and register their vehicle, but they drop their insurance the next month because they can't afford it. Almost every case of the angel families that I know that their loved one has been killed by a drunk illegal driver, they did not have insurance. And so that has left the family in another devastating position where they don't have any type of insurance that would cover the funeral costs or anything for their loved one that they have to bury. And we have nowhere to turn. We don't have any pro-American organizations that reach out to help us for funeral costs, for anything. And when you look on the internet at how many pro-illegal alien groups there are and the money that's poured into it and given to these people, this is what's so sad to me, what this country is becoming.
Don't you think it's possible that Americans can do both, that they can want to support you and also want to support not criminals, but the immigrants that are fleeing from violence in other countries, crossing our border. Isn't it possible that Americans can do both?
Americans do support immigrants. And the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is an immigrant has started their paperwork and they're coming into our country the right way. And it's just been proven by this latest wave of all of these people coming from Honduras and saying that they're fleeing violence. To say that they're afraid of gang violence isn't proof that their life is in danger. Look, you and I are afraid of gang violence here in the United States. It's all around us. You know, we need to send the help and the resources, and these people need to start standing up to their government and their country and fight there.
Miriam Mendoza, I'm imagining that all the work that you're doing keeps your son, the police officer's memory, alive for you.
Absolutely.
By the way, did you ever think of joining forces with the huge number of grieving families, mourning people killed by drunk drivers, period?
I've been approached by them, but, you know, I've got my own fight in my belly of what I'm fighting about and the very reason of why my son was killed. And that's where I'm directing my energy. And obviously, I'm against drunk driving no matter what. And it's pretty sad because Maricopa County, Arizona, has one of the strongest and stringent, you know, drunk driving laws in the country. And the amount of times that it happens here is staggering.
And your son was one of those who enforced those laws.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's Marianne Mendoza. Her son, Brandon, was killed in 2014, a head-on collision with a wrong-way drunk driver who was undocumented. Marianne, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And she mentioned $136 billion of services for undocumented immigrants. PolitiFact says that number does not include taxes they pay, more than $13 billion. And we spoke to an economist who said immigrants boost economies. She spoke of immigrants waiting for deportation. The government has been criticized for not being prepared for the backlog. But she says one life lost to someone who shouldn't be here is one too many. So we'd love to hear your thoughts. HereNow.org.
It's 2-0. That's a rocket. Smoked into the corner, and that ball is gone!
The Red Sox's J.D. Martinez last night in Toronto, crushing a 3-run home run off the left field foul pole. The Sox beating the Blue Jays 10-5. Hardly news, because Boston has 81 wins this season, by far the best record in baseball. Can I say that again, Mike Pesca? The best record in baseball. Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. How good are the Red Sox?
Well, if they lose every single game in the rest of the season, they'll still be a 500 team, so that's impressive. They're so good that they actually have a shot at the record for the most wins in the history of baseball. It's an outside shot because, I mean, they're playing at such a tremendous pace, and last year the Dodgers looked good and they tailed off at the end. But if the season ended and they kept on this pace after 162 games, they will have over 110 wins. Most wins were the Seattle Mariners in 2001 with 116. You know what the big caveat with that 116 Mariners. Do you remember the Mariners hoisting that trophy? They did not win the World Series that year.
There you go. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, are the Red Sox better than the teams that won the World Series in 2013, 7-04? Can we extrapolate?
Well, I would say some of those teams seemed magical. And a curse-busting team is a thing that will always be remembered. I think this is the best Red Sox team, especially offensively, that I have ever seen. And, the only problem is baseball. Baseball itself. Baseball is a funny game. And in a seven-game series, you have a couple of bad swings. And things don't always turn out for the great baseball team like they do the great basketball team. The great dominant basketball or football team almost always wins, you know. I don't have to tell you your undefeated Patriots were an exception, but in baseball, it's a lot different.
Okay.
Mike, I think what Robin is really trying to ask here is, would you say incredible, amazing? How would you describe the Red Sox?
Which word would you choose?
Right.
And what happened to the...
It's thesaurus night at the stadium. Right. The first 10,000 fans.
But what
gets
happened
a
to the Yankees? What happened to the Yankees? I am from New York originally. What happened to the Yankees?
They came into town. They're a good team, and they'll make the playoffs because these days, all the good good teams make the playoffs. But they came into town and they got crushed. They lost 3 out of 4. They're missing Aaron Judge, their best player. It's not an excuse. They have this amazing bullpen, but their starting pitchers aren't that good. And when there's a problem with the bullpen, the team's not going to win. I'll throw this out there. Their first-year manager, Aaron Boone, a very good player. He seems to be getting outmanaged a lot.
Okay.
Mike, we have to ask you about LeBron James. I know we've been talking to you about him in recent weeks. He has been in the news a lot. He recently opened this new school for at-risk kids in Ohio. There's a petition going around now calling for him to replace Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. There's been this feud between Trump and James. But tell us more about what's going on here.
I guess Donald Trump decided to draw some battle lines because perhaps, I don't know. Let's not ascribe it to anything other than a fit of pique. But in an interview with Don Lemon, LeBron James said something mildly critical, but also accurate about the president being divisive on matters of race. And LeBron James was ruining that because, he said that race and sports have been the thing that united me. Sports united me and first introduced me to white people. And here Donald Trump is being divisive about sports, which I think, again, is a non-controversial statement. So Donald Trump weighed in and called him and Don Lemon, questioned their intelligence, which has a sordid history of its own. But what I would say is after that, if Donald Trump really did want to draw battle lines, if maybe in the back of his mind he was like, this worked for me with the anthem, it's not working for him at all. I'm not saying that his most fervent supporters will defect over this, but even the First Lady, unbidden, weighed in and said, I'm more with LeBron James. What he's doing is amazing. And since then, I think everyone who's looked at this has said, I shouldn't speak with too broad a brush, but everyone who's looked at this, even among them, the crazy sports casters whose job it is to fault LeBron James, find no fault with LeBron James. Can't believe anyone would be criticized for funding this school, which is exactly what we need in America. And there's the Betsy DeVos comparison, putting up his record. Sure, it's perhaps a microcosm of the entire national education system against DeVos. The one school that LeBron seems to have funded seems to be going pretty well.
Okay, just a few seconds that we have here. I just have to mention, because I'm going to hear from all our dear listeners in Houston. The Houston Astros are dominating the American League West again this year. We were talking about baseball. They have 73 wins. They won the World Series last year. So I just want to have said, of course we know Houston has a team as well. Okay.
Houston exists. Cleveland exists. These are other teams
that exist. These places exist. Mike Pesca here now is a sports analyst. He's also editor of the book Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
And Robin, I am here in New York today, we should say, because we are going to be reporting on Hudson Yards. This is the largest private real estate development in the history of the United States. When it is done, it will include over 18 million square feet of space for residences, office space, retail stores. So we're going to look at what it takes to put together a huge project like this. There are like 5 skyscrapers under construction right now on the west side of Manhattan.
Are you going over there?
We are going to be there.
Fabulous.
Hopefully we'll go right up to the top of one of those unfinished buildings.
What a view. I'm jealous. Okay, we'll look for that.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.